From here to here is probably around 4 to 6 microseconds. And it's, for some reason, it's a bit of a loop not locking. Or maybe this is 800 by 600, this is 640 by 480, and we're seeing a beep.
Would there be simply a slight irregularity in batteries fed in log loop?
No, irregularity in the data. No, this is something constant. This is a mathematical phenomenon. If it was irregularity, you'd see something more like noise. Mm-hmm. You see these bands are rock steady. See how the band goes right out?
Yeah.
Another band here. And X-configurable. Or no, X-configurable. Oh, a little bit for this. All that.
Excuse me.
Hey.
Is this a one time thing, or are you starting early?
No, I'm just talking.
Well, wait a minute, you go with
the real recording here.
I'll come over with you.
Oh,
did we get it?
Sorry,
did we record?
Yes.
What? So, you have to talk to Richard.
Put that thing in
the
Power on the
Okay. I'll just go over the conditions. What's the opposite of a prerequisite? No. Where I recommend you don't come. Okay. This lecture is going to be given in the tone that's appropriate for either beginners or intermediate Linux programmers. If you have already hacked the kernel, if you have contributed changes to the Linux tree, if you've written device drivers or a virtual memory manager, this lecture is probably at too low a level. And I politely suggest that you may want to look at one of the other talks that's going on. There will be some code discussion here, but most of the next 2 hours will be architecture. Nobody's leaving. All right. But by all means, if you find in the first hour that this lecture is beneath you, please, I won't be insulted. Go learn something useful. Okay. The purpose behind the next 2 hours is to try and explain how the memory management system works in Linux, how it's a little bit different from the way we were all taught in school. It's a lot simpler than you may think. Because it's simpler, it can be written in smaller code. Because it's smaller code, it can be more reliable. More people can understand it. More people can party on the code and make it cleaner. And that's how we got to where we are today. So it's really keep it simple, so keep it reliable and fast and easy for people to maintain. Okay, here we go. Where's my audio guy? Check.
Yeah, you're not getting any actual audio.
Okay, but
it is recording.
Carry on. Okay. It's nice to see some people in here that are my age. Anybody remember Nielsen and Oblio and Arrow? Excellent. The point. Yep. You gotta be over 30 to get that one. 40, I guess. What I want to do is cover most of the next 2 hours is gonna be deal with what happens when an app is loaded. What happens in the memory in the kernel when you try and launch an app. Tied in with that is a discussion of file mapping. Those of you that took operating systems in school were probably taught, okay, here's an operating system, it looks after your hard disk, and then the prof will probably tell you about open, close, read, write. It says, introduces the concept of a file, you open it, you read it, you play with the memory, you write the file, and you close it down. But they, later on, at the end of the course, or later on when you're opening up a real textbook, you come across another call that you can make on a file, memmap. Memmap establishes a one-to-one relationship between a bunch of memory and a file. And the way it's taught in school is it's taught as an afterthought, or as a nice, neat bonus way where you can actually play with a file without actually having to do opens and closes. What if we turn that around? What if we said we're going to make file mapping a fundamental part of everything that we do with files? And then reads and writes after that are incidental. They're the byproduct. Okay? And let's build an entire operating system around that principle. Okay? Doing that, I'm going to demonstrate in the next couple hours, is going to give us demand loading, interop security, virtual memory, shared apps, shared pages of apps in kernel space, and a whole bunch of good stuff. What's a memory map? A memory map is an entry in a table. Okay? So let's make a table like this, where we've got an address. Where's Mike? Ah, I knew I'd have a reason. I knew I bought this for a reason. Let's suppose we've got an address. An entry in the memory map table consists of rows in this table. The left-hand rows describe an address in the user space. Okay? So let's suppose there's an app running. Let's suppose somebody just ran dir. Dir is a process. It started up. Dir is running. The following entries probably exist in the file mapping table. The first entry has got two numbers here. That represents a zone in the app's memory space. Okay? So it's an address and a length. The second two columns indicate the name of a file and the distance into the file. And with any luck, it's the same length. I'll get into that a little bit later. And because, so we've got now we've got a correspondence between a zone in the user's memory space and a section of the file on disk. And there's some extra flags on there too. This first entry in the memmap table is marked as read-only and executable. So that's where the code is. The second entry is marked read-write and not executable, and that's where the data is. Who needs a mouse anyway? An entry in the memmap table is just that. I haven't yet. Okay, let me just say, it's possible to have an entry in this table without any actually having any physical memory associated with it, or without having any file associated with it. Okay. So when I say memmap, I mean an entry in this table. It doesn't mean I've actually allocated any memory yet, or I haven't spun the disk yet. It's just an entry in the table. So if you're going along writing code and you say file open doesn't take very long. Well, it shouldn't take very long. Immediately after the file open, I can call memmap, memmap, memmap. They don't take very long. Because all a memmap has to do is put an entry in this table. It doesn't spin the disk, doesn't allocate memory, it just puts an entry in the table. Alright, so I'll show you a little bit later how that all works. The best example that I came across in the kernel to illustrate what's involved and the advantages that are involved in memmapping is launching an app. What happens when we launch an app? Well, an app on disk consists of... Is red a good color? Probably not this red. An app on disk consists of a header, a bunch of code, and a bunch of data. And usually there's some resources, debugging, and symbols involved at the end of the file. Depending on what family you come from, there may be resources here. If you strip the file and it's a console-based file, there's no resources. It's just header, code, and data. Now, the header contains some interesting stuff. The header contains a tag to say what type of file it is. and a table of contents. It's the trouble with a lot of uptime. Your RAM is all allocated. Well, we'll wait. So there's a table of contents here. The table of contents says where the code is, where the data is, and where the symbols are. The act of what does the kernel have to do when he loads an app for execution? Well, the first thing he does is open the file, of course. And then the next thing he does is reads the first 80 or so bytes. Now, there's something that's not obvious to people. When Linus or ourselves are writing code to go in the kernel, we're not allowed to call libc functions, right? You can't call fopen and fprint, and you can't call math functions and all that kind of stuff. And Jess pointed that out this morning. But you can call kernel calls. So it's perfectly fine for the kernel to call open. I mean, open is an interface that the kernel publishes to the rest of us, but he can use it himself. Memmap and seek are functions that the kernel publishes to the rest of the world, but the kernel uses it itself. The kernel uses the same techniques that we use to do things. Okay. Sorry, guys. Wasn't like this last night. My life? No. Okay. Which one am I on? There we go. This is the code in the kernel that actually loads an ELF binary. Okay? And what I'm going to do is zip through it and show you that it's not quite as intimidating as it might seem. It's in fs/binformat_elf.c. First thing he does is fortunately, the file's already been opened. Remember I said he opens the file and he reads the first 50 or 80 bytes? Well, the reason for that is he has to find out, is this an ELF file, is it a library, is it a.out, or is it a shell script? So he opens it up and he looks at the first few bytes and decides it's ELF and it's executable. So we already know that. So on the way in here, he checks the first few bytes and he checks to make sure that, yes, it is an ELF executable. If it is an ELF executable and it's not a dynamic, it's not part of a library, then he goes ahead and this test succeeds and we carry on down into the rest of the code. And then he calls read. Now actually he calls read exec because read is for the general public. It's for user apps. But this is the synonym, the equivalent call available for kernel authors. Now the table of contents. Table of contents indicates that this file has 5 zones in it.
We're in a swap CD, I apologize.
Would rebooting help?
Take time off the rebooting.
Yeah. Table of contents indicates these 5 zones. Now, this zone is marked loadable, and this zone is marked loadable.
This is overhead, and this is overhead. So what the kernel does, is goes into a loop, and he goes through the table of contents, and each one of these that needs to be loaded is memmap. So there's a for loop that's created for the length of the table of contents. If the type is loadable, then he calls memmap on the file. Memmap on the file and associates it with a piece of memory. Memmap runs very quickly.
Did you not say there were five sections?
Yes, there's five. There's another tiny one in here, which holds the name of the interpreter, which is it's a byproduct of dynamic linking. What's the magic key for sync?
Alt print screen S. Then you.
You unmount.
Yes. Yeah. To wake up at is 08048000. It's just a convention. I can justify it if anybody wants to. Okay, so we got a bunch of code mapped in. Now the code in the table of contents, it indicates not only where it wants to go, but what type it is. So this code is brought in as read-only and executable. Right. Now the for loop continues to run and it finds there's another entry in the table of contents which should be brought in. So this stuff is brought in and it's marked read-write, not executable. All right. This is data. Now we've done mem-mapping the file. We've got a couple other things we have to do. The data on disk is usually smaller than the amount of data that you actually need for your app. Okay? Any initialized variables appear in here. So any variables which you've set to be non-zero appear in here. But there's a very good chance you've got a lot of other data which is zero. And that's put in a pretend space called BSS. And the linker doesn't bother wasting file space with all your BSS. So it just marks the fact that the amount of data that you want is bigger than the amount of data actually on disk. So what has to happen now is somebody has got to expand this into a place called BSS. Now the BSS space, how was the BSS space created? Well, we need a bunch of zeros very quickly. So let's suppose the kernel's got some way of making zeros very quickly. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Dun dun dun.
But remember, the first statement I said is that what if we built an operating system based on the fact that everything is min-maxed. Okay. Let me modify that a little bit. Every piece of memory associated with the user app is min-maxed. When the kernel makes memory for itself, it's not min-maxed. Okay? So we'll leave that stuff out of the equation. I'm talking about loading a user app, making a user app available. All user app space has a memmap association. Okay. We got this. We need a bunch of zeros. Okay. Remember I said there's a file here? And we're making file mapping relationship between the data on disk and the data in memory. What if we had another file, which happens to be called dev0, and we make an association between this and there. If this is guaranteed to be full of zeros, now I can have a bunch of stuff that's guaranteed to be full of zeros. Now, if we make this 4K in size, what happens if we need more than 4K? Well, we just map it many times. If you need a megabyte of empty zeros, you just map this in 250 times, you got a megabyte worth of zeros. Now, let me explain. What should we do first? Back to the lecture? Yes. See, sometimes it's fast. I think the problem was I ripped all the title bars off. I ripped these three title bars off and I shoved them over to the side, and every time I do that, the machine seems to go nuts. Zeros. Now this table. Entries in this table, let me pause on this process for a minute. Entries in this table are simply that. It's a 40-byte or a 50-byte structure that the kernel creates, fills in with a bunch of data. Now, he doesn't actually store it as an array. He stores it as a linked list. Okay, so we can have lots of these. Small apps would have a few of them. Big apps would have lots of them. But it's stored as a linked list. The existence of something in here has not yet precipitated any disk or memory activity. Okay? Let's suppose there's an entry in here corresponding to this code. Nothing has happened yet. Now, let's suppose that this app jumps, or this process jumps to a piece of code here and starts to execute. Well, when the memory in a process is first created, it's marked completely not present, fault. So as soon as somebody jumps the code here, the processor is going to fault and say there's no memory there. So the kernel gets woken up, the memory manager gets woken up and said, hey, the user just tried to party on an unavailable piece of memory. First thing the memory manager does is walks this list. And he says, oh, geez, you know, sure that memory doesn't exist, but it's supposed to exist. Let's suppose they pick some address like this. I can use my some address like this for a memory fault. Well, the memory manager is going to look at this and say, okay, I know where that memory is supposed to come from. At that point, the memory manager goes to the memory pool, gets a bunch of real physical memory, then he spins a disk, and he goes out to wherever this file is, bin dir, seeks to the beginning, and asks the device driver to create to read the data into memory. And then he returns to the caller. And the caller can go ahead and do the code execution. See what I mean? So it's only when you actually bang on the data that the disk spins and that the memory is instantiated. So you can, let's suppose this is a 20 megabyte executable, Netscape plus WordPerfect overload. You can actually load that pretty quick. Because what the kernel does when he loads it is create the memmap tables. And it's only when you jump to the code that the memory is required and the disk is spun. Equally, you can ask for a megabyte or 10 megabytes of empty zeros. And this association is
is only created when you start partying with the zeros. Yep.
How much is actually loaded on each access, on each memory block?
I don't know. Russell, do you know what the kernel, what the current... okay. What I'm... Do you know?
It's several pages.
Yeah.
It's only the required pages, plus into the application space.
Well, I'm not... Today, I'm not going to talk about buffers. Okay? Everything I'm talking about now is theory. And then there's the user space. It turns out that there's a layer in there called buffers, which I'm not even going to deal with today. And buffers' job is to intercede between what I'm talking about today and the user's demands, and to do things like read ahead and bulk reads and fill up all the unused memory. And it's an orthogonal kind of service that I'm not even going to deal with today. All right. Now, what happens if we're executing code here? Well, code executions involve reading, so that's all right. Similarly here, if somebody starts reading this data, that's no problem. He's going to spin the disk, the data's going to get mapped in, and he's going to read it. What happens if somebody, if this app now makes a change to this data? Well, the way memmap works is we make a one-to-one relationship between we make a relationship between information on disk and information in memory. And all I've been talking about so far is read. But what happens if we do a write and we modify the RAM, the memory? Because it's such a tight relationship, that modification to memory will get forwarded to the disk. Okay? That's what file mapping is all about. Well, in this particular case, that's probably not a good thing, because this is your executable. And you don't want changes. This is the memory version. You don't want the app making changes in here, going back and screwing up the original. You're safe with the code. You don't have to worry about it modifying the code. But you can modify the data. And we don't want the changes to go back. So this zone is also marked COW, copy on write, which means that it invokes something interesting. When this stuff was brought into memory, I said it was marked read-write. In fact, what the hardware does is temporarily mark it read-only. When it's clean and brought in the first time, it's marked read-only physically. Okay? As far as the app's concerned, it's still read-write. But the memory manager thinks it's marked read-only. So as long as people are reading from it, it stays untouched. It's a version. But the first time somebody writes to it causes a memory fault. It goes back into the memory manager. Memory manager looks at this list and says, right. He's supposed to be read-write. So what he does is he goes and gets another piece of memory, copies all this stuff, 4K, lets the change, the write, happen, and then returns. So as far as the app's concerned, nothing ever happened. But as far as you and I are concerned in this room, another piece of memory was pulled out of the pool, the data was copied, and the change was allowed to go through.
So,
yep.
Is the memmap entry then changed according to the new data?
Sir, you're leaping ahead about 5 minutes. If I don't get to it, remind me. Okay. Now, what happens when the app starts making changes to BSS space? Well, it's the same thing. We want this to be read-write. Not executable. And we'll mark it copy on write as well. So that as long as you're reading this, you're reading zeros, because you're physically reading them from dev zero. But when you start writing on them, the memory pool is invoked, a real page is brought in, the zeros are copied, no need to copy the zeros because there's faster ways to do that, and then the change is allowed. And then from then on, the app deals with this new piece of memory. Now, important thing to appreciate at this point, that let's suppose this stuff is all still virgin, still full of zeros. As long as you're reading from it, you are actually reading from that single entry. So there's a 4K page somewhere in your RAM, and you're pointing to it many, many times. And I've got a demo here which shows that effect. It's just a curse call. Okay. This first loop is just to show the loop overhead. If I read a megabyte of zeros, so I instantiate a megabyte of zeros, and I start reading it in a tight loop, I can read it in about two nanoseconds overhead, above and beyond the loop, each byte. If you want to get rid of the you know, the PCI bus or the Pentium bus reads 64 bits at a time. It reads like a whole bunch of stuff into cache at a time. If you want to get rid of that effect, you can skip by 32 or 64, and you get rid of that effect. But in any case, as long as I'm reading this repeatedly, it's in the cache. So I can sweep through a megabyte. I think I'm sweeping through a megabyte, but it's actually in the cache, so I'm reading this stuff bloody fast. If I go out there and I dirty it, so I just had a tiny little loop that went in there and wrote some crap in here, just scattered some stuff, which poisoned this, and it caused a real megabyte to be instantiated. Oh, now I have a megabyte less of RAM. Anyway. until this point, I had to use the, you know, bulk memory, but now it's dirty. Real memory is invoked, and sweeping through that's a lot slower because it's not cached. My cache isn't big enough to hold the whole megabyte. So first I'm reading this, and this, and this, and this. By the time I get down here, that's out of the cache. So even if I go around the megabyte many times, it's not in the cache, and it's way slower. So not that it's an efficiency problem. This is just to indicate to you what's happening here, and the fact that as long as you wake up a bunch of zeros and read them, you're not using memory, and you're fast. Well, you're fast if you're looping around, which is a silly thing to do. You instantiate it. You know it's full of zeros. Why do you have to read it? Anyway, okay, now we have to rewind about 10 microseconds, okay? That's a joke. Yeah. Let's go back to the kernel loading an app. The kernel loading an app reads the header. Oh, I can show you the header now. User bin there. There we go. Okay. This is what's in the 80 byte header. It just says it's an executable and it's little endian and where the start address is and that kind of stuff. Then there's the table of contents. Table of contents has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, sorry. Six zones. And notice two of them are marked loadable. So the for loop runs through any time he finds an entry in the table of contents that's loadable, he creates an entry in the memmap table. I haven't created any memory yet or spin the disk. We just put an entry in the memmap table. Now, looking at this a little bit more, this says where it is on disk, where we want it in RAM, how big it is on disk, and how big it is in RAM. Now notice the, and then this is marked readable and executable, this is marked rewritable. Readable and executable, that's probably code. Now this is interesting, because notice the header doesn't say this is code and this is data. The header contains enough raw information so that the for loop can run bloody fast. So it's sort of a generalization thing. That the linker, next year's linker could do something really bizarre and have code and pseudocode and whatever they want. The code is at this location in the file, this offset in the file 0, and it's this long on file and this long on disk. So we can just make a one-to-one memmap. But check out the data. The data is read-write, and it's this big on the file and it's this big in memory. So that's the business about having, this is our data zone, but we've got this much on disk, so the rest of it has to be filled with zeros. And if you want to actually get into the source code, you'll see that this area is filled with zeros manually up until the first page, until the page boundary. Once we hit a page boundary, then dev zero is mapped in many times, as many times as required. Bring us up to this point. Now, if anybody wants to play with this diagnostic tool, let me go back to the top. That's a dump of the header. And I lied when I said that there's a table of contents. In fact, there's two table of contents. There's a coarse table of contents and a fine table of contents. And they use different words. One is segments and one is sections. Sections are the tiny things. They were the details of the sections are put in by the linker, and they're for things like GDB and analysis tools and stuff. And it's a fine-grained breakdown. But if you look at how these things are laid out, they're clumped together because immediately following that is the coarse table of contents, and that's the one that the dynamic loader uses. That the kernel uses this table to create the minmap entries. Yeah.
Hi. Could you give me an example of when a header table entry would not be readable? Why would you have that?
You're right. Silly.
So you could just not have that flag there.
Right. Anybody? Yeah. It's not readable. It's a stretch. But we always put the flag in, the read flag in.
Okay, sure.
Have
your way.
Maybe I'm missing something, but is that 0804800 always the same in every app?
On current x86 apps, that's always the same. But if you go to PowerPC or ARM Linux, this number wanders a little bit. It's not. This number is not sacred. It's just the linker that we're all using uses that.
Is that a physical location, or is that because?
No, that's a logical location. It's a convention. Now, the reason it's not zero is because we don't want anything on the zero page, especially on processors like the StrongArm. You have to stay away in the Macintosh. You have to stay away from the zero page. But it's actually pushed up. What is this? 128 megabytes up from zero. The reason is sometimes we have to put stuff down there. When you get into dynamic loading, you'll see there's a case where we actually have to put an app down here. So it's pushed up a bit. Where the 4.8 comes from beats me.
And I guess there must be a mapping meaning that number for every app in the physical memory.
Say again?
And there must be, because if I have two apps,
yep,
they have two separate locations in memory. But they both
no,
have
no. Each process gets its own memory map. So if this is DIR and this is the X server over here, he is allowed to use the same numbers over again, but he gets different memory maps. Okay. So there's the fine table of contents, the coarse table of contents, and then there's more stuff and relock tables and stuff. Anyway, let me point out something in the fine table of contents. All this stuff here, these are the fix-ups for runtime binding. This is the constructor code for the library. This is fix-up helpers for code jumps. And this is the code itself. These are destructors for the library, and this is read-only data. What do all of those have in common? They're all readable. They're all read-only. So they're all clumped together. So they're all in this zone. So this is code plus read-only data. Now down here, we've got data, which is the stuff I've been talking about so far. Constructor tables for C++. GOT, which is the data aspect of runtime fix-ups. And BSS. And what do they all have in common? They're all volatile. They're all changeable. So the linker puts them all together, so that when we get the coarse table of contents, they're all in here. Okay, I'm going to have to speed things up. Oh, I had one in the lecture.
Shoot.
Okay, before we can start executing, though, So far, we've done three memmaps. Bang, 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 fast. Like a memmap is 5 to 10 microseconds. So by the time these are created, we're into maybe 20, maybe 40 or 50 microseconds. We haven't even had to spin the disk yet. Before we can execute this, we need stack. So how do we make a stack? Well, we memmap another something. What should we memmap? We'll memmap dev 0 again, okay? So this guy is marked read-write, possibly executable, copy-on-write. Now the reason it's possibly executable is because when you get into things like nested functions in C++, exception handling, all that kind of stuff, sometimes you have to create code on the stack and execute it. So this is actually executable area. It's nasty, but it has to be done.
Is that what GCC calls the trampolines?
Trampolines are done in here, yeah. In addition, this has an extra flag on it, grow down. Which means grow down is a special flag. When Linus was making up his design of the kernel, it's his, right? He can do anything he wants. So he threw this flag in, because he knows everybody needs a stack. It's like mom, you need a stack. And so it's a special marker so that if the memory manager gets a memory fault in this area, right next to the stack, instead of aborting and killing the app, he simply makes the stack a little bigger, which he does by simply memmapping another one of these. So the stack automatically grows in one direction. That way, we don't have to worry about stack growth. It's all buried deep inside the memory manager. And really, it's probably only another 10 lines of code. I haven't actually found it myself, but you can imagine, just look, if it's nearby the stack, you just bring in another page and off you go. It's at this point that we're actually ready to start executing. Now, there's a couple more things that need to be done before we can execute. First thing that happens is the kernel needs to bring in the argv and the environment variables. So he does that by writing stuff on the stack. Well, that's the first memory access. So far, we haven't accessed any of this. So as soon as the kernel goes to put args and environment on the stack, that's going to cause a page fault. The copy-on-write mechanism will engage. A page will be created, and the environment, and we'll have the environment and the args here on the stack. Okay. Then the instruction pointer is put on the stack. You can do the kernel, instead of actually jumping to the code, he puts the instruction pointer on the stack and says, "Hey, do a return from subroutine." So it nets out to the same thing. As soon as the kernel releases this task to run, it does a return from subroutine, comes into the code, tries to fetch something from here. Well, that creates a page fault. Now we spin the disk, get the memory, read it, and make the association. It's now. Who's right? Yeah, loaf of bread? Okay, I'll be home. It's now that we're spending time and we're actually spinning the disk. Yo.
How do you get the information of how big the code and the data is if you don't spin the disk?
No, it's in the header. It's in that table of contents. Yes. Okay.
How do you get the header without spinning
the disk? The disk was spun once. When somebody invokes it, so when somebody hits the enter key now, the kernel, in a generic piece of code, spins a disk, reads the first 100 bytes, and he looks at the signature at the top. Is this a library? Is this an ELF executable? Is it a script file? Is it a Perl file? And he analyzes it, and then he goes to different code. And the particular example I'm talking about today is he's already decided it's ELF code. Okay. So we have the table of contents already. So yes, there's always the header's always read in first by using an open and a read. Okay. So now we are able to execute, and you can imagine this whole chain of events. Propagating all, memory fault, read, bind, memory fault, get some more memory, read, bind, and the whole thing runs. Yes?
I can understand it in the data portion where you have the copy on write so that you don't change back on the disk.
Right.
With the BSS and the stack and such, where you're mapping those from dev 0, when the copy on write, when you do write to those areas, when that copy on write copies, doesn't that then allocate more memory for the copy of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But then the original can be marked discardable.
Got it.
So it's the first guy to go out on a folder.
Okay. So you just move it to another place.
Unless another app opens it.
Unless another app opens which?
The same file.
Okay.
Now, for things like Dir, it's not a big deal. But everybody's got to open up libc. Mm-hmm. So you open up libc, it gets mem mapped in and used. I open up libc, it gets mem mapped in and used. The read-only parts of the data, the virgin copy of the data, there's a very good chance that we're all using the same virgin copy. So it doesn't get thrown out right away. You're right.
Because someone else might be using that same segment that you're using.
Right.
But it can be reclaimed.
It's wasted space. But if its use count is zero, he's the first guy to go out.
Got it.
Might as well keep it in memory until the last minute, because someone else might need it.
Right.
So it's sort of wasted, but sort of not. Okay. So what have we covered so far? We've got demand loading. And as a byproduct of that, fast startup. Okay, but check out what's happening here. If an app needs a bunch of zeros, he gets them. If an app needs to do a malloc, he needs a whole bunch of memory space. Linus never gives an app memory space directly. He always gives him dev zero first with a copy on write flag, which means there's no way you're ever going to get a piece of memory in your app that was used by another app. So you're not going to see passwords or anything. Same with the stack. You will never see anything that somebody else put on their stack because you always get a zeroed version of it first. Yo.
This means also we can assume on Linux that any memory we get is automatically zeroed?
Yep.
It's not portable, though.
To Unix, no. But to Linux, yes. So we get this aspect of inter-app security. As a byproduct of the architecture, okay? There's no explicit code to do these. These are all free byproducts of the architecture. So we got demand loading. Oh, yeah, we got fast bulk zeros.
Zeros.
You can have as many zeros as you want. Doesn't cost anything.
Was this all serendipity?
No. No. This is a result of 30 years of Unix design. It's just each Unix got more and more refined, and Linus happened to be in the 1991, happened to take all of the evolution, the good parts, and put it together in the right order. To be honest with you, I can't tell you whether he did this in this way on purpose or not. But this is the state of the kernel today. another thing is, the actual code which runs to load this, to create the four mem maps, 1, 2, 3, 4, we're only talking about 250 lines of code. I could show it to you, but I don't know. We'll do it after, because I'm going to run overtime, so. All of this discussion based on statically linked apps. Okay? Now I'm going to play a little bit with you here. What happens if the app needs to call malloc and you need 200 small objects? When you call malloc, it does not go to the kernel. It goes to libc. In other words, the kernel does not look after all the little dirty pieces, the dirty overhead of hundreds and thousands of small objects. Libc does that. Now, libc is operating in user space, so libc is in here somewhere. If this is a statically linked app, then libc is in here somewhere. So when you call malloc, you're going to libc. And libc is going to turn around and ask the kernel for more memory. And it does that through a call break, brk. No, sorry, sbrk. SBRK means move the breakpoint. This, ladies and germs, is the breakpoint. Okay? It's a single scalar value which says how much memory I've given to the app so far. So when libc asks for more memory, he simply moves the breakpoint down, and we get more memory. And how is that memory created? It's another entry in the memmap table, which is here. So it'll be just another entry in this table, and it associates this file with this memory. Bingo, you got more zeros. And the kernel doesn't have to track hundreds and thousands of small objects, just a single point.
Just to reiterate, the breakpoint is a virtual memory address. It's
yes.
not an actual physical memory.
That's right. So each app gets its own breakpoint. If you look at a task structure, each app is a task, right? And you could have 20 or 30 tasks running in your machine. And each task has where the code starts, where the first instruction is, where the current stack pointer is, where the current breakpointer is, what its nice level is, who the owner was, what they can, you know, all the stuff that goes with task management. And each one gets its own. And you're running your app here, you're going to be using numbers like 0804. This number here is going to be 0806C000. And right beside you is another app that could be using the same numbers. You don't care what numbers the other app is using. But you do know for a fact that you guys all have separate memory as long as it's copy on write. If it's dirty, copy on write, you have separate memory. If you and another app are both sharing libc, then you will in fact be sharing code from the disk and physical DRAM with the chips. What's in the actual physical chips is the same memory for both apps.
I only ask that when you move the breakpoint, it doesn't necessarily allocate contiguous memory. It could go to another page that is then mapped from physical to virtual page numbers by the kernel or something, right?
Well, the way libc works in Linux is it only ever moves the breakpoint up by an integral number of pages. So there's an agreement between the authors of libc and the kernel that the breakpoint will only ever move up on page boundaries. If you don't, the kernel will correct you and give you more memory than you asked for.
Yes, but when you do move up a single integer page, it doesn't necessarily mean it's contiguous. There's a mapping between virtual and physical pages.
Yes, but it's physically not contiguous. If you're doing DMA, then you have to think about this. If you're not doing DMA, and if you're just like the rest of us writing code, you don't need to worry about it. It appears to you to be contiguous.
Sure.
Yes. So the guys that need to worry about that are DMA device drivers. Yes. If you need DMA memory, come and see me later. You're in another world. You're writing kernel code. You're not writing user code. And so what I'm talking about today is for you guys writing user code, not him and me writing kernel code. Okay. Okay. Now, so far I've talked about memmap, where the memmap table says this is where the memory is supposed to go in the user's space. You can also call memmap with a don't care. You can say, I've got a file on disk. I want a memmap of it in my space, but just put it wherever you want. Once the app is up and running, that's the typical use of memmap. So, by default, Linus decided that memmaps, if you don't care where a memmap goes, it's going to go here, at 4000000. So if you just call memmap, you're going to get, your memmaps are going to appear here in your space. A couple other things that go here. So far, I've been talking about statically linked app. Statically linked app means your code is in here, but libc is in here as well, your constructors, whatever other libraries you need are in here. So this is probably a megabyte, right? We don't like that. We want to do dynamic linking. What dynamic linking means is your code is here and nothing else, except for overhead. And when your app launches, someone, specifically this guy, ldlinux.so.2. When you run a dynamic app, this guy actually comes in first and starts executing. And he will go and find libc for you and bring it in here. Poly.so is an app running in user space. This is not in the kernel. This is out in the world with you. So he's calling memmap on your behalf with the don't care flag set. So if he memmaps something with the don't care flag set, it comes in here at 4 billion. Yo.
Doesn't that impose an arbitrary limit to the application size? Mine is large, but...
Okay, that's exactly where I was going. Oh. Yep. So, in this area, from 4 billion downwards, is where, if you do any memmaps, this is where they go. If anybody does a memmap on your behalf, like the libraries, that's where they go. So your libraries tend to go there. Now, all the libraries in this world, in the ELF world, are relocatable. So they don't care if they're at 40000 or 401 or 402. It doesn't matter, because they're relocatable. And finally, remember I said if you call malloc, well, if libc is down here, actually, your code is going along. When you call malloc, it comes down here, and malloc's down here. Libc is executing. If you call for a small malloc, they actually show up in here. And he gives you more mallocs by calling the sbreak and enlarging his BSS space. And that's how you get small mallocs. If you ask for a big malloc, the new glibc says, oh, he needs a bunch of zeros. And he memmaps this in again for you. So there's three things that show up here. Let me do another version of this because it's getting clustered. If this is the memory space, from 0 downwards, you get your code and your data and your BSS and your small mallocs. From 4, 0000000, I'm glad we're not on an alpha here, you get your libs, your large mallocs, libs, large mallocs, and any memmaps that you do yourself. And from C 0000000 upwards, you get your stack. So Eric was just asking a minute ago, what are the numbers like? Well, in this world, you've effectively got a gigabyte for your code, data, BSS. And you've got 2 gigabytes, which are shared. One going this way with your libs, large mallocs, and memmaps, and another gigabyte going this way for your stack. So there's your 3 gigabytes. Yes?
So that implies that the biggest memory object you can have is around a gigabyte and a half.
On an x86? Yeah. Now, if you use the standard unmodified linker as it is today, you're right. You're going to get limits like this. 1 gigabyte is the maximum code you can have, reduced by however much data you have. If you are very careful about your code and possibly use a modified linker and modified libraries, you can enlarge this at the expense of these. So you can move things around. The linker is flexible enough to let you do that. So we've got a gigabyte used by libs, large mallocs, and memmaps, and another gigabyte used by stack, but they're heading towards each other. So if you ask for more of this, you get less of that. The only person, like usually a stack. How much memory do you need for a stack? Hey, I built a machine which used 32 bytes of stack. These days, how much do you need for stack? A half a megabyte? Yeah, 128K, something like that. So usually this is not a big problem. Libc takes advantage of this huge space for pthreads. As if we get enough time, I'll cover the threading model. The threading model basically is, we've got an app here with code, data, BSS, libraries, and stack. The machine wakes up every 10 milliseconds and executes this, and then goes to sleep, goes to something else, and the app appears to run. The scheduler holds a single entry for this. If we put another entry in the scheduler, so that with a different stack pointer, then what happens is we go around the scheduler, we get to entry number 1 in the scheduler, it comes here, starts executing code using this stack. then the scheduler cuts in and switches over to task two. Task two is the same app space, but using a different stack. Okay? Which means it's going to do a return from subroutine to some other code. So the scheduler simply has two entries pointing at the same data space, two different stacks. It appears to be two threads of code running through your single app space. If you, and so by convention, I don't know about the other architectures, but certainly on the x86 and the strong arm, every thread that you create here jumps up 2 megabytes. So you get 2 megabytes of stack for each thread. So if you go up to 500 threads, which is brain damage, then you're going to use up your gigabyte of stack.
So with the different threads, are actually sharing all the data space?
Yeah.
So they could... You've got to be careful you're not writing in one and then writing in the other and expecting...
Oh, yeah. That's the problem of writing thread-safe code. Yeah. So it's interesting because the fork call in Linux does two things. It creates a new mem space and it creates a new entry in the scheduler. New entry in the scheduler, new mem space, you've got a new app running. Clone only does the new entry in the scheduler. It does not create the new app space. So it's just like, he wrote this code, and this code was like an if statement. If it's not really a full fork, if it's a partial fork, then I'll create a new entry in the scheduler, but I won't do anything with the mem map. Bingo, you got threads. Well, you got threads that glibc is willing to help you. All of the startup and shutdown for threads is in glibc. But the actual scheduling is done by just doing a sort of a half-baked fork. Okay, fork off. Glibc. Okay. Now, is that big enough? S-trace goes to standard out or standard error?
Standard error.
Yep. Nope. Oh. Standard error. Is there a way to pipe standard error to a file?
Do 2 greater than ampersand 1, and then everything will be piped to standard error.
Yep.
This is bash.
2 greater than
ampersand
1.
Okay.
I
use that every day.
Excellent. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit. I'm going to erase this because I have to rebuild it, and it's getting too dirty. Oh, no, sorry. I got to deal with this gentleman's question. These are managed by entries in the memmap table. 1, 2, 3, 4. As long as we're reading from these two, we're reading off the equivalent of the disk. As long as we're reading from these two, we're reading off dev zero. As soon as somebody does a write, a modification to either the data space, the BSS space, or the stack, a copy on write is invoked, which means another piece of memory is woken up. And this memory, these numbers, this memory, this apparent address space is now bound to the new copy. But remember I said everything is associated with the file. So when the new copy is created, we're going to bind it to, let's suppose it's here. We're going to bind it to a special file called swap. Now, because of the flexibility of Linux, you can actually have the swap file here. Temp swap. One, or you could have it here, dev hda3, or you could put it on a network, or you could put it on your serial port if you wanted.
Okay.
But because anything that you can open for anybody who didn't laugh must be asleep. You can leave now. No, but because of the generality of the system, we can dump those dirty sectors on any device that the file system can see. So it could be a file within a file system, or it could be a whole partition. Or it could be a whole empty disk if you wanted. Dev HDB. Okay? So now we've introduced a concept. I need black to do this, right?
Black. Nope, that's red.
That's black. We got virtual memory. Implemented on a flexible target swap device. As a matter of fact, you can have multiple swap devices. Nobody says that this swap concept, that these dirty blocks have to be associated with a single swap file. We could have multiple named swap files, which is, I don't know if you've seen in Linux, you can extend your swap system bigger. That's how I should fix this sucker. I hate teaching in the real life. Okay. So we've got all of these things happen as byproducts, implicit byproducts of the architecture. There's more. I like this flippy board thing. It's great. Okay, let's look at dynamic loading. This is your memory space, stack at the bottom, app at the top. So I'm going to make it a little smaller. Code, data. By the way, there's a gap between code and data because this has to be read-only, this is read-write, and it has to happen on a page boundary. So they're spread out apart a little bit. Code, data, BSS. BSS is moving down here. The loader. When the loader runs, the first thing he does is check at the top of your app, is this dynamically linked or statically linked? If he does statically linked, it's exactly what I described. If it's a dynamically linked object, first thing he does is go into the beginning of the file. This is the disk. This is the copy of the stuff on disk. Remember I said there was a header at the top? Inside the header is a reference to libld.linux.so.2. And first thing he does is memmap that in here. ld.linux.so.2. And instead of jumping to your code to execute, he actually jumps into here to execute. And this guy, it's not in the kernel. It's on your side of the fence. Okay? This guy is smart enough to do the following. There's a list in here of all the libraries that you need, like libc. He takes this list, and he memmaps those in twice, once for code, once for data. So you get libc, code and data. Code and data, libc, and libm, whatever other libraries that you need are brought in, code, data, code, data, code, data, code, data. Okay? Then he's smart enough to go around and fix up all the data references. All right? So that pointers, which you used to have to things, which, you, like, if you're pointing at arnow, you think that's a variable. Well, it's down here somewhere. So your code, your data has to be fixed up to point to it. Notice the codes are never touched. Only the datas are fixed up. Because the codes are read-only, and this guy's operating on your behalf, so he can't access it either. So the data areas are fixed up. What's interesting, though, is the subroutines are not. So the data fix-ups are done, but the subroutines are deferred. They're left alone. Turns out there's a very clever system built in the linker, so that when the linker made this for you, code and data, and debugging, the linker was very careful to leave this stuff and this stuff in a perfect condition so that when you memmap it in, your subroutines are in a state so that when you execute them, the fix-ups are done as you need them. So they're very carefully designed so that when you are traveling along here and you hit a subroutine that you haven't hit before, it goes through this trampoline fix-up code. Then, at runtime, it makes the binding. And then the next time you call that same subroutine, you'll go to the right place. Yes?
Are there, like, if you wanted it all preloaded because
yes.
you had some passing, is there
yeah.
compiler switches and that
it's
sort of thing?
It's just LD_preload.
Okay.
You can also say which libraries you want preloaded.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very flexible. Okay, let's freeze this for a minute, and I'll show you some of that, some of the byproducts of this stuff.
You had a question?
Yeah.
What's happening if the memory is not free when you try to auto-define the dynamic library?
Your toast.
So basically, you can call anywhere in the cloud without paying. Who produced that?
Sorry. Okay, why don't we deal with the out-of-memory conditions off later, because this could turn into quite a long discussion, and I don't want to... I'm going to go over time as it is. This is a dump of my copy of Dir. Dir only needs one library. It needs libc.so.sys. And also in the header is a marker saying what interpreter we want. There it is. This is our loader. This is our this is the guy who is doing the dynamic loading and binding for us on our behalf. So that's the same image that I put here. ldlinux.so is loaded here at 4 billion, and libc is loaded at 4 billion. If you want to see where stuff would go if you loaded it, it's ldd, user bin dir. And that gives us a dump about where ldlinux.so would go if it was loaded, and where libc.so.sys will go when it's loaded. Just diagnostics to say, you know, where these numbers are. Also, it's handy if you want to see what other libraries that are needed. That's all stored in there. Now, this guy, ldlinux.so.2, he gets woken up every quarter second, because almost every single app on a modern Linux distribution is built with dynamic loading. So everybody's saying, hey, give me my libraries. So this guy's being woken up all the time. So, of course, he's mapped in once and repeated it. But he's got a job to do. He's got to go find all these libraries. Now, actually opening a named entity, opening a file, and it files a named entity, is actually not that cheap, because you've got to parse directories and all kinds of stuff. So this guy actually keeps a cache of where the popular libraries are, so that the next time he's used, he just go to the cache. So he knows where libc is, libm, libx, libqt, and all that good stuff. He keeps this cache in etc ld.so.cache. I know, for those of you in the know, this is old hat, but I'm seeing some faces here that haven't seen this before. So.
What happens if you update libc? You know, you're developing libc, so you just made yourself a new copy. You want to turn it down.
Yeah.
How do you destroy the pointer, the fast file?
Let's go through that off time, but the common technique is to use symbolic links and maybe a change root. But it's in the how-tos. Yeah, it's tricky, tricky stuff. Don't do it unless you're a masochist, right, Rob? Libc. Scott, how long is a libc build? Hours, right?
Two and a half.
Yeah. Okay, so LD Linux manages this little cache. This is binary. Now, it turns out it doesn't refresh this automatically. You have to do it, or somebody has to do it. So if you're running Red Hat and you call RPM, or you're running Debian and you call dpackage, every time they bring a new library into your machine, they call this thing ldconfig, which is intended to be run offline. And what it does is it sweeps through your hard disk looking for all the libraries, puts the locations in the cache so that LD Linux can find them. Okay? This guy only reads the cache. This guy writes the cache. Now, if you want to, like I said, this is binary. If you want to see what's in here, run ldconfig minus p, and it'll give you a human readable form of what's in the cache. So it just says where the libraries are, so that ld.linux can find them quickly. Right, now let's do this one. This should be in here. S-trace, there we go. I'm going to actually trace the kernel calls into dir. I just did a dir, okay? So there should be about 5 files in here. Let's run through this quickly. I can never find a laser. Okay. First thing that happens is the app itself is executed. Now, somebody said, is this dynamic loading mechanism flexible? Yes. One of the flexible aspects is it looks for a file called ld.so.preload. Now, I don't happen to have one on my machine. But if there was one on my machine, it would find it and do whatever the preload commands were, config stuff. How long am I allowed to go through?
It's been still 20 minutes, I think.
That's okay. Then he opens ld.so.cache, just like I said. And he memmaps it. I mean, why read when you can memmap? And it's an interesting thing. I don't know why this is done. But you're allowed to close the file after you memmap it. And you still keep the memory, which is a bit odd. I'm not sure about that. Don't quote me. Then he opens up libc, reads the header. Again, you've got to read the header to find out if it's ELF or script or what the heck it is. So he reads a big chunk. Well, that's another thing. If you're going to read a little bit, you might as well read a big chunk. Because the hardware is going to spin the disk anyway and do a little read-ahead for you. Then he memmaps a megabyte. That's code.
So Matt, the question, the amount of data that's being read in from the header is like, is it block size of a hard drive? I mean, I noticed you're reading more 4K there.
Yeah, I don't know why that got picked. You've got to read it to the page. You're going to dirty a page in, yeah. Well, that's another thing. If you read it in, you might as well. You're probably going to need that page anyway. So, okay. The memory is brought in, and it's actually made read-write for a little while. There's a long story behind that. Then that's code. Then there's data. And then there's, who's this? Mapping from 3. Okay, that's libc as well. I don't know why there's 2 in here.
How can you map it? Well, this could be 3 closed.
No, this is a different 3.
Oh, oops, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then now I wanted to show you this. Somebody in dir is obviously called malloc because the break marker has been moved up a couple of times. And you see we get more memory each time. So the break marker is up by much. The break marker has been moved in a direction to give the app more zeros. Then it's, so at this point, the app itself is starting to run. See where it says get pid? There, that's about where the app itself is starting to run. Everything before that is library loading. So the app starts to run here, and if we had the source code, I think you'd see a good correspondence between what's going on here. That is probably a get pid call. There's probably a bunch of mallocs going in here. And then get directory entries. See these? So dir is now starting to do the interesting stuff. He's getting the directory entries. And then later on, he's writing to standard output the following strings. And there they are, close, unmap, and exit. So that explains what the break marker is, if anybody... I haven't seen the break marker for years. I never knew what the heck it was, and now I do. Now you do. Okay. So far I've been talking about a memmap entry. An entry in the memmap table being address and length of where it is in the user space, address and length of where it is on the file, and a few flags. Well, in real life, it's a little bit more than that. There's some overhead here to make it a linked list. Where's the linked list overhead here? linked list overhead here. And he actually uses different names, like VM start, VM end. That's these addresses. VM offset is the distance down within the file, whatever file you happen to choose from. And he doesn't keep the file name. He keeps the inodes. You want to avoid storing names wherever possible, because you don't know how long they are. But internally, it's all done by storing these numbers, these inodes. Where are they? There. And this is interesting. Each entry has a pointer to an array of functions, just like C++. So one entry in the table could be pointing at entries which know how to manage a hard disk, and another memmap entry could be pointing at entries which know how to manage a SCSI device, an NFS device, whatever. And by substituting different tables in here, you can have the methods, the verb part of this thing, completely different. There's my naive version of the table. And again, one more entry, one more repetition. Entries in this table do not necessarily indicate the existence of real memory or a real file. It's only when it's invoked. Again, this is a typical entry, say, for dir. We have code and data here. A real table would also have a third entry here for BSS, and then a big gap, and going down here to ld.linux.so, which is the helper routine, and then this would be followed by libraries, and then it would be followed by the stack. Okay. What's on this other side? If anybody here ever called memmap from an app? Okay, so you guys have probably noticed that the invocation of memmap is a pointer is equal to memmap. Memmap. Here you put in where you want it to end up in your own memory space, and usually that's a don't care. Then you have to put some flags in here, like map. Which goes first, maps or props? Maps. Map read, ORed with map write. And then you have to put prot read, ORed with prot write. And then you put in the
size.
Size. And the file, the handle. Then the file offset. And it always bugged me. Why do I have two sets here? Well, it turns out, I wonder if the props go first. Shoot. Wouldn't want to tell you the wrong thing.
Look at the S trace.
Yeah, the S trace.
Which one?
Just go
the
up.
S-trace?
You've got S trace in
there. Look at the
S trace.
No, not me. Maybe I do.
You piped it to less.
Yeah.
Props are first. Okay. The props. So. I better do this in case somebody's writing it down. I get sued. prot, map. The first set are the ones that get tied to the hardware memory management system. So you're saying here that I want the memory that's created to be read or writable or executable. If you want your write protection on the memory, it goes here. These ones are the properties that you want on the file. Now, usually they match up. If it's readable, it's readable. If it's writable, it's writable. But remember I talked about this copy on write? In the case of copy on write, you want the memory to be writable, but not the disk. So the flags are broken out into two pieces. Now, The memory flags also have some extra things that you can toss on them, like grows down, shared, private, anonymous. Anonymous is the trigger for copy on write. So I use copy on write because it's sort of an explanatory kind of word. But if you're writing code and wandering around the H files, you'll see anonymous. Or private, sorry. Private's the trigger for copy on write. Showed you the zero page access. Okay. That is that. So, as byproducts of this architecture, black again, we get code sharing. The libraries, remember I said libc gets brought in here? Libc is code and data. The code is about 4 megabytes, the data is about 20 kilobytes. So it's really, it's more like this. The code is very, very carefully crafted to be read-only. Now, even though we have to do fix-ups here, like your code is going along and he calls printf. Printf is down here in libc. Well, this fix-up, but this jump from here to here has to be done while the machine is running, because we don't know exactly where this address is. Fine, fair enough. But libc is also calling other libraries, like libnss. Anything with an nss on it drives me nuts. Anyway, that's a libc joke. Libc is also calling other libraries, and those subroutine calls are variable addresses. We don't know where they are. So you'd think, from a naive point of view, that while libc is running, the code would have to be modified. But there's a very careful crafting of the architecture, and they don't actually... When libc is running, let me blow this up again. We got code, and we got data. The code is going along and calling, and let's suppose he goes to call... what would libc call? They might call COAST, for instance. Somewhere in the middle. So he calls COAST, 17 call. It turns out there's an entry down here, and he jumps and he fetches from here, and that says where COAST really is. So the fix-up is done in here in the code space. In the data space. Very carefully crafted so that the code is never touched. Therefore, you know that however many times you use libc, 10 times, 50 times, 100 times, the code part of it is virgin. It's never modified, which means, and it's 90% of the memory requirement, right? It's mostly code. That stuff is shared between all the tasks that are running in the machine. So we get good code sharing. By the way, that little anecdote, in order for this business to happen, this interlock business to happen, we need extra space in the data. Actually, and I should mention that this COAST subroutine, it actually goes up here first to a place called PLT, and then that jumps down here. Bottom line, you write a bunch of, let's suppose you're writing a library. You write a bunch of, you compile your C code, you get a bunch of code data, and you glue them all together, and you've got a lib. The linker will glue them all together for you, and you'll have librebel.so. It turns out that it's not just a matter of gluing all of your codes together and all of your datas together. There's some extra overhead that needs to be added above and beyond the code that you wrote. There's an extra piece of code created here called PLT, and there's an extra piece of data called gut. And these are synthesized by the linker. You don't have to create them. You don't allocate them or anything. But But they make your libraries 2% bigger than you expected. And these areas, the PLT and the GOT, are used, they're interwoven strongly, and they're used to make sure that the code section of your libraries is never modified. That your libraries can exist completely pure code, unmodified code. The code's never touched. All the fix-ups are done in Dagestan. Therefore, we get good code sharing. It's awful code to read and understand, but it's done once, right? It's done, it works, it's pretty good. And it does cost you a time penalty. Libraries written with all this gobbledygook jumping around with PLTs and GOTs run slower than libraries written without it. On the other hand, the code gets to be shared. So your machine needs less physical RAM. You can run on a 16-meg machine instead of a 32-meg machine. So your machine runs faster. The net is your machine runs faster. Your code sharing. Oh, this one is hard to enumerate. It's hard to justify without bringing out code up, but jump in. There's a file. It's user source Linux fs bin format underscore elf dot c. And in the middle of that is a small subroutine that actually does what I told you about code loading. It's simple. Because it's simple, it's easy to understand, it's easy to debug. There's only, it's general. He can load all kinds of different apps with and without dynamic linking, and it's reliable. We get forms of inter-app security because of the fact that you never get old memory. You always start off with zeros. You have lots of zeros very quickly. And the swap mechanism is almost a free extension of the architecture, and the swap system is flexible. You can go to a swap device, a swap drive, a swap wireless. Maybe swap over the wireless. Okay, let's do questions. I know there were some over here dealing with out-of-memory conditions. I'm going to ignore them. Start back. Yeah.
Fairly simple one. I wouldn't want to do this myself, but if I were to do something like self-modifiable code, would you mark the code as read-write-execute? Or is that even possible?
Read-write-execute is perfectly fine. It's just you don't get the benefits of sharing it with other instances.
I just thought I'd ask.
As a matter of fact, for some reason, ld.so, this helper routine, when he's bringing code in, he brings it in writable. And then he modifies it. There's an mprotect call. And he changes it from writable to read-only. And I'd have to go through the... It's in the docs somewhere why he did it that way. But it's still a fair bit of that around. So he brings the libraries in as writable at the beginning. But as long as nobody touches them, they're... The dirty bit's never set, so it doesn't precipitate the copy on write. Yes?
Quick question back to copy on write. When that copy is performed, when you do a write, does the address within the application's memory map change, or
no.
Does the physical location of it change? Just the physical location.
Just the physical location. As far as the app's concerned, it's business as usual. Just plow
right.
On ahead.
It's just been done behind the scenes.
Yeah, Eric.
What's the boundary determining a small malloc from a large malloc?
16K? I think it's 16K. Today. And it's optional. You can turn it off.
On the same theme, is there a nice way to redefine the boundaries where stack lives, where the boundary between small and large alloc
it's
lives?
In your linker script. Look around in your... Is it in this? No, it's compiled into the linker. If you... Here, I'd love to do this. Hey, why not?
Okay. That's how I read Word documents.
Right. Okay. At the end of ld.so, or sorry, of the linker, ld, are these things. Linker scripts. And there's about, what, 6 or 8 of them in there? And they say how a static app should be built, how a dynamic app should be built. And there's a few others in there that I don't think even apply to Linux, but they're still being built into the kernel linker. You can make your own text file equivalent of these and tell the linker that for this particular build, I want to use this text, this linker script, which says where things get loaded in what order. You can put data before code, anything you want. You can say where the start address is. What else? It's just, this linker script is instructions saying when you're taking all the .o's and gluing them into an executable, go into the .o's and bring out the datas, glue them all together, bring out the codes and glue them all together, bring out the relocks and glue them all together, what order they should be put in, and where they should live in the app's memory space. So there's plenty of flexibility there. As a matter of fact, when we build, anybody here familiar with the Netwinder project? Yes? Yes, well, you should be, anyway. you know that the boot prom, the BIOS in a Netwinder is in fact a full kernel. We needed to find a way that we could boot from floppy, SCSI, serial, Ethernet. Instead of writing all that code, we just used a kernel. We put a kernel in Flash. Now, to build that kernel, it goes at funny addresses. So we run the C compiler in the assembler, but then in the last stage, the linker, we tell the linker that it goes at these addresses. So we already take advantage of that for our project. It goes into Flash, of course. It executes, it finds the real kernel, and then it disappears. So we don't have to worry about long-term implications. But you can control the linker with the linker script.
Is there any place where you can go for a tutorial on this?
It's right. Pretty obscure. No, $100 an hour would get you a tutorial. All right. I'm going to sit out there for the next infinite amount of time to handle any questions. But we need to clear the room and give you guys some air. But I'll be sitting in the hallway.